This is a Triple J podcast.
People are so scared of portrayals of queer and trans sex, like in media. We just don't see it. You know, it's always like, oh, look, they're having a sweet, sweet kiss.
Hey, Dee here for the Hookup Pod and super excited for you to listen to this episode because a lot of you have told us that you're huge fans of erotica, you love reading horny tales, and you've also told us, some of you have told us that you've never read any smut before, but you're someone who's not really into watching porn, but you want to find a way to get turned on or explore your sexuality. Well, this next book I'm going to introduce you to might be for you. It's called Eros, Queer Myths for Lovers, and it's the debut novel from an actor you might know from the A24 film Talk to Me, or maybe from the TV series Nine Perfect Strangers, or if you're a Marvel fan, from their latest series Ironheart. Their name is Zoe Tarakis, and their book Eros is basically five sexy short stories that are ancient Greek myths. Some you might know, like the well-known story of Icarus. And so Zoe has rewritten these myths, right? But in a way that really embraces how so many of these old tales are actually stories of queer and trans love and tragedy. So yeah, in this ep, we'll chat about how they discovered so many ancient stories were actually stories of queer gods and goddesses and why it's so important for these myths to be retold. We'll talk about their journey, going to Greece and Crete, where their family's from, and also the process of writing the book, as well as how they now have a whole new love of writing about sex. It is a really fun chat. I learned so much from reading Eros and from chatting to Zoe, so I hope you do too. All right, let's get into it. Thank you so much for coming into the studio, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
So before we chat about the book properly, you have a really beautiful family and cultural connection to this novel that I want to chat about and hear, you know, how it came about. Why in particular did you want to focus on ancient Greek mythology?
Well, I mean, it's where I come from, and they're the stories that I sort of, as a Greek kid, as a queer kid, grew up kind of obsessed with. You know, I feel like even Anglo queer kids have this fascination with Greek myth because they're kind of, you know, dark and sexy. And when you're a kid, you're like, oh, this is kind of awesome, you know? And I think tenfold as a Greek person, you know, you go, oh my God, these are my old stories, you know, and there was a pride there always. And I think getting to delve into them as an adult and fully see how dark and sexy and messed up and magnificent they are was such a gift.
We'll chat more about the stories and the ones that you ended up focusing on, but what was your family's cultural background and where in Greece are they from?
So my family's from Crete, which is the island at the bottom of Greece. It's like the arse end of Greece, just above Egypt and Libya, in between southern Italy and Turkey. So it's kind of this melting pot of cultures, essentially. And it was home to the Minoans, who were one of the oldest civilizations. And the Minoans traded with Egypt, Syria, Palestine, and Turkey. And so our food is different. Our myth is different. And that's something that is reflected in my book, in really so many Cretan myths. And yeah, and when I was reading Ovid's Metamorphoses, the story of Iphis and Ianthe, which I know we'll touch on later, that is, as per his telling, an Egyptian goddess that comes to the island of Crete to visit this family. So the kind of, there was just more, I guess, fluidity in terms of cultures there. And it kind of, everybody had a piece of Crete for a time, like at the port in Chania on Crete. It's a Venetian port with a mosque on it. Like, it's just so, wow. It's such a melting pot, really, which just makes it home to some pretty remarkable stories.
Yeah, that sounds spectacular. I've done a few of the Greek islands, but I've never done Crete. And yeah, I can imagine that that would be not something you'd expect to see rocking up to see a mosque there.
Yeah.
You went for the first time. What was that like, visiting a place that you'd heard so many stories about, but also where your family was from?
It was so moving, I think, especially because, you know, I'd never been to any of Greece before. and my family, we'd gone to Athens, and I mean, I had the most amazing time in Athens, but I didn't necessarily feel that like connection that people talk about when they visit where they have ancestry for the first time, and sort of waiting. And then the second we set foot on Crete, I was like, oh my God. Like there was a scarab beetle just kind of, as I got off the plane, there was just one on the ground. And then we got to where we were staying, and the architecture is just so different. Like it's less of those sort of classic European columns, and it's more blues and browns and reds, and the water's a different color, and it's just like this big fucking, oh, am I allowed to swear?
Sorry. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's
God,
this
yeah.
big
yeah.
rock, really, like in the middle of the sea, in between sort of the Aegean Sea and the Libyan Sea. And I couldn't believe it. Like it was, we went to this, the Palace of Knossos, which is where Icarus is set in the book. And I just burst into tears. I could not stop crying. I was just
wow.
so moved by the whole thing. Yeah.
How did it make you feel about your identity? Because I know for a lot of people who have cultural backgrounds that live in Australia that have never been to where they're from or where their family's from, like when you do go there, it is a bit of a like a puzzle fits into, like a piece falling into place. Like you kind of just go like, oh, this makes sense.
Yeah.
Did you have any moments like that? Like how did it shape how you felt about you?
Yeah, I definitely did. I think as well, because, you know, such is the case with a lot of immigrants and immigrant families, is like our histories are passed down in a way that can often be lesser and lesser with each sort of set of hands that passes it down. And my great-grandfather came here from Crete, met his partner, his wife, who was born in Port Said in Egypt but was Cretan. On the boat, they came here. And I think my grandfather still had a lot of culture and a lot of language, and he didn't pass that on to my dad and my dad's brothers. And, you know, I think part of that is assimilation, you know, and part of it is just probably not thinking it's worth anything, which is very sad. And so I think, you know, a lot of my generation of sort of diasporic migrant families kind of have this weird thing of like, fuck, I want to invest in this and investigate this, but I don't know where to start really, because my dad didn't get taught any language and any, you know. Yeah, so it's kind of, it has been a process of unfurling this stuff and being in Crete where people just like, they just looked like me, you know, like they had my skin color and like my wide face and big nose, and you know, like it was just that thing, and eating food that you go, oh, my body feels good when I eat this way, and there's fucking olive trees everywhere and goats blocking the road, you know, like it just kind of, it was so, just felt so right, I think.
Was Eros, like writing Eros, something that came from when you were in Crete that you were like inspired to write, or was it something that you always knew that you wanted to do?
No, so I had already written half the book by the time I was there.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely went back and fixed some things up afterwards, like, because I'd written Icarus, which is obviously set, like I said, in Knossos. And when I got to the palace, I was like, well, I'm going to need to rewrite some things. I was like, that's not how I described it. Yeah, no, I wanted to do it before that and had started it before that.
Why was it something that you wanted to write? How did that process come about?
It was weird, actually. Benjamin Law reached out and was like, do you reckon you got a book in you? I was like, is that a sex joke? And he was like, no. And then I thought he meant a book about myself. And I was like, take a fucking hike, doll. No way. I was 23 at the time, 23-year-old writing a memoir. Suck eggs. And he was like, no, it can be about anything. And I was like, oh, okay, like that I'm curious about, and sort of went away and thought about it for a few weeks, and then got just obsessed with the idea and couldn't stop thinking about it, and wrote up this pitch so that by the time the next, you know, me and Ben talk next, I was like, yeah, yeah, you know, it's just like, here's everything I've planned. And it happened, and I now cannot imagine a life without writing and without having been able to sit in these stories for years. And like, it's just actually changed the course of my life.
Wow. Because was writing, because you people would absolutely know you as an actor and from a lot of the incredible things you've been in, was writing something that you never thought, or has it been like a bit of a passion you've secretly might have, or, you know, been like nurturing on the side?
I mean, it's weird. It's like definitely, I don't know. I've always found words accessible, and words have always been something that have been easy for me to find. Like if something is going on in myself or in the world, or I'm trying to make sense of something, I tend to be able to find the words for the thing, but I'd never sort of thought of that as anything that could be turned into it. I don't know, like as a skill, I was just like, oh, I'm good at describing things, I suppose. And yeah, and so not really, like I didn't even read. Like I could read obs, but like I didn't.
You're like, just to clarify,
Lea Michele. Yeah,
you have to read scripts. So.
yeah, exactly. But I didn't really read, like, start reading books properly until I was like 19, and then I just like have made up for lost time and just got obsessed with reading, and so have always like have been a big reader for the past like what, 6-7 years or something. But yeah, the writing thing just really kind of took everybody by surprise, myself included. And it's weird. It's like when you just stumble upon something that you never thought you would do or was meant for you or was a possibility, and now it's like full sliding doors moment of like, I just actually don't want to do life without this thing now.
And also you're so fucking good at it. Like it feels like you had been a writer for years, like the type of quality. And just like you said, like having the words to describe thing before we jumped on mic, I was like, my biggest takeaway from the book was just how incredibly descriptive you were able to like use metaphors and language that I would never even think about, but it changed the way that I thought about love and sex and just people's relationships. Going into like, you know, that excitement that you had around doing this, and you're like, this makes sense, I really want to do this. What was then the process when it came to researching these myths, right? Because for you listening, basically Zoe takes 5 ancient Greek myths, and which we'll, you're going to unpack in a bit, and, you know, re-kind of writes them and modernize them through a queer lens. So when you were looking into this, what were you finding, and how did you kind of decide these are the stories that I want to rewrite?
Well, there was my dad always says this thing, which is that Greeks invented sex and Romans invented sex with women. Like, because there is so much gay sex in Greek culture and Greek myth. So there was no shortage. Like, I had a list of about 20 that I was like, what do I choose? And that's not me like imbuing queerness where it isn't. Like, that is like, okay, so I've got Hercules fucking this dude. I've got like Orpheus having an orgy after Eurydice's death. Like, it's like everywhere. Like, it was actually a process of culling and a process of going, okay, what kinds of love do I want to appear in this book? And what types of sex do I want these people to be having? And what types of queerness do I want to appear in this book? And so it's sort of like, I guess, finding myths that complemented each other and making sure that, like, not box ticking, obviously, but just going like, I don't want this book to be all gay men, or I don't want this book to be like all cis women, you know? So just having like a really good balance of stories and types of love, I suppose. And I think I found that in the end, but fuck me, it took a while. It did my head in for a bit. Because also Greek myths are so violent and so often tragic. And finding ways to, I guess, tell them that they're not ultimately, like, they're certainly not all ultimately positive, but that does not underpin everything. Like, it's not just sort of like a trauma dump of queer history. You know, that's not what I wanted to write.
Yeah. And there is such a balance of the violence and the tragedy and the love, though. And that's what, yeah, I took away. It was like there were some parts that were hard to read. Yeah. One story in particular, one myth, is Iphis and Ianthe.
Ianthe.
So close. I know. I was saying before as well that I don't actually know a lot about Greek mythology, ancient Greek mythology. I know Icarus. Everyone knows, like, flew too close to the sun.
Yeah,
But I just, yeah, I don't know a lot of the ancient myths. And so I was saying to you before that, like, now if people talk to me about these stories, I'm only going to see them through your lens. Like, I'm only going to be like,
he's gay as hell.
He tried to suck the dick of a bowler and got burnt.
Right.
Got too close to the sun. And it wasn't actually a dick.
True story.
That's the only way I'm going to think about it now. Okay, so with this one in particular, this tells the story of a trans boy, right? Mm-hmm. What was the OG story, right? Mm-hmm. And then how did you rewrite it, if you did at all?
Yeah. So Iphis and Ianthe, it's weird. It's like, it's not surprising you don't know it. Nobody knows this myth. And this one I did have to dig around for a little bit. And it was actually, it's in Ovid's Metamorphoses. And like, the way it's written there is like, basically, there's this girl and she's going to get a penis, but she doesn't really want one. She just has to get one because she wants to marry this woman she's fallen in love with, who doesn't know she doesn't have a penis because she looks like a boy, and that she's so disgusted with herself that she is in love with another woman that she almost wishes it was a cow, because bestiality is better than being a lesbian. So there was a fair bit to strip out of that, but I'd seen like a bunch of, you know, not homophobic and transphobic tellings of this myth, and then sort of went back to the original and just, I mean, with so many of these stories, it was just a process of stripping out the layers of sexism and misogyny and queerphobia.
And shame as well,
and
right?
And shame.
Yeah.
Like, shame that is put in the mouths of these characters against their will, and just going, what's in the bones? Like, what are the bones of this story without these men's perspectives over the top or opinions over the top? And what I found, the bones were this trans boy in Crete who falls in love with his best friend, who's a girl, and the goddess Isis comes over from Egypt and grants him a dick. That is the bones of this myth, you know, without other people's perspectives laid on top. And so my job then became to let these stories exist with my opinion over the top, which is that queerness is not bestiality and is not an inherently shameful, sinful thing. And it's so, like, you just kind of get led by the story. Like, I really was led by, once I stripped all that away, it's like the myth just kind of takes you with it. And I don't know, it just felt like a real conversation that I was able to have with these stories. And I don't know, particularly that story, obviously I feel very close to that myth because it's a fucking trans boy in Crete, which is just crazy, you know, like, it's just crazy. Blew my mind. And has been, like, I don't know, in conversations about, like, transness being this new phenomenon and, you know, the rise in fascism and Nazism around the world, it's like, it's been pretty special to have actual concrete evidence that somebody like me existed over 7,000 years ago. Really, it's pretty cool.
It's incredible. And this was something that you speak about as well in your foreword. You wrote that in a world that grows darker and more violent towards trans people each day, I find myself more and more reliant on nature. What did you mean by that? And what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I think, like, in 2023, I found, which is when I started writing the book, was also just after I had top surgery. I kind of, you know, that's to me when I really started to feel this sort of turfism and Nazism and increase in transphobic rhetoric, like, kick off again, the most I'd seen it in my lifetime. And it sort of just built from there to where we are now. And yeah, I just felt people's eyes on me at the pool, walking down the street. I was getting some pretty fucked up shit in my DMs. Like, it was, you know, it was pretty nasty. And people's kind of language around trans people, that we are a threat to women and children, and that, you know, we are something that should be exterminated from public life. Like, it starts to get under your skin. It starts to get in. And, you know, I love kids. Like, kids are a massive part of my life. My partner has kids. Like, I love children. And I started to hear that voice in my head, like going, am I a threat to women and children? Like you start to, it gets inside your own brain, that propaganda. And then with that, there's just like the questions that people feel like they have permission to ask you, you know, are so crazy. Like, and just the fact that a body that you wake up with in the morning, that you just like shower and go to sleep with, is up for public debate. It's so wild. Anyway, and so I think I didn't even really clock it until much later in the piece, but I just started gardening heaps and like wanting to surf more and wanting to, like, instead of go out to that thing, just like plant tomato seeds. And then like that became just wanting to go camping all the time and camping by myself. And it was, yeah, only sort of with hindsight that I was like, oh, of course I want to be in nature more. Like, I didn't correlate these two things, but they are so intrinsically linked. Like, of course I want to, because nature doesn't ask questions and nature doesn't debate who you are. And nature also, like, as long as nature, I talk about this in the introduction of the book, but as long as nature has existed, so has transness. Like, 2 million years ago, there was trans fungi, trans mycelium, that became trans frogs, trans fish, barramundi, all trans, hyenas. Like, nature depends on transness so heavily for its own species to survive. And humans are no different to that. So nature looks at transness and welcomes it. It's like, this is invention, you know, this is creation. And that is so life affirming when people are looking at you and seeing deformity.
That's literally what nature means. It means natural. Yeah. It's like, this is natural.
Completely.
It is so fucked that people politically get to pick and choose what parts of evolution they decide suits their arguments. Totally. And what totally doesn't. It's like, oh, we know, we love that part of nature, the part where men are stronger.
Yeah.
Getting violent, naturally violent.
Yeah.
But we don't like that natural thing. Nah. Don't like that part
so
of evolution.
Picky choosy, hey. Yeah. It's actually, I haven't thought about it like that. It's so true.
It's like whatever suits their whatever suits their argument. And another thing you write, which is kind of on point of this, is queer and trans love has always existed, but our stories have been minimized, folded down by male historians into smaller and smaller pieces until they disappeared entirely. These men have twisted our love into friendship, our desire into shame, our fluidity into binary. How has it felt to be able to write these stories and reclaim them and bring them to the forefront again, especially when they've always been there?
Like, such a privilege, hey. Like, I think as well, you know, with all that, with the rhetoric in the world right now, like, getting to spend time in stories where transness is so natural and queerness is just like a life source, it's been really good for me. It's been really good for my head, you know? And it's really sort of given meaning to that phrase, like, that queer and trans people have always existed. Like, I think I found myself saying it so much, but not really having the meaning behind it when I said it. And it's just been a real privilege to get to spend a lot of time padding that with meaning. And this is just my culture. You go into any ancient culture and queerness and transness are there in plain sight. Any indigenous culture, you know, like, and often queer people and trans people were sacred people. Same in my culture, same in, like, you know, Blackfell away here. So many places these people are like chosen people, you know, or medicine people or gods in my case. And yeah, it's just been, it's been a real honor to get to remember that and hopefully allow for some like collective remembering, and that we can all, like, anybody who reads this, I hope can feel that in themselves and feel like that oldness, and that we are not a contemporary problem to be solved. We are far from it.
I feel like you kind of answered it, but my next question was going to be, what do you hope that people take away from reading the novel?
Yeah, that, I guess. Yeah. But also just, I don't know. I so don't think that way. Like, I so don't think very goals oriented. Like, I'm like so much about like, this is what this story is and what somebody else makes of it. I just have no fucking idea, which is why I'm so curious talking to people, because I'm like, I don't even know what you would begin to think about this story, you know? But I guess like, yeah, I hope that people, I hope that people who aren't queer or trans see that like three-dimensional, fucked up, messy trans characters should exist and that they're really important, because I think that's really lacking. And for the queers and trans people, like, it's for us, especially ethnic queers and trans people. I'm like, I wrote this for us so we can remember who we are and return to it, you know, away from the noise. And also just because I think even though there's some monstrosity in it and some pretty heavy shit in it, it's also just like, it's sexy.
You know? It really is. Like, I was reading it next to my partner last night and I just like had to be like, I was like, I need to watch Seinfeld to go to sleep right now. And he was like, why? You just read a book. And I was like, no, I don't think you understand. I was like, I need to calm down.
It's hot. Like,
it's really hot. I need to watch something just like smooth brain.
Yeah, totally.
I was like, totally. Steaming. I was like, it was so hot.
Yeah, it's hot. Yeah. It's hot. They have good sex in this book.
I wasn't expecting it. I really wasn't. But I was just like, fuck, this is like, this makes sense, right? It yeah. just like made complete sense.
Well, I think as well, like, people are so scared of portrayals of queer and trans sex, like in media. We just don't see it, you know? It's always like, oh, look, they're having a sweet, sweet kiss, or like, oh, she's getting raped, you know? Like, there's kind of no in between. It's either sexual violence or really vanilla. And so I think like that was also really important, is just going like, don't be afraid of this. Like, this is, it's like trans sex is so beautiful. It's so beautiful, and I am not gonna shy away from it just because it's like a bit daunting to people. It's like, actually, you'll get your rocks off. Like, you already do, I bet, you know.
Absolutely. And that was a thing that I loved, like, you know, as like our listeners know, we talk about it a lot on The Hookup, but like a conversation we have regularly is trying to unlearn what mainstream media has taught us around sex just being penetration, right?
Yeah.
And I felt like there was so much in this of just like fucking that was like describing fingers going here and this going there, and it was just so hot. And it's like trying to challenge this idea that like fucking doesn't mean a penis into a vagina.
Mm-hmm. And it's also what we're talking about nature as well. It's like, sex is invention too, in nature as well. Like, have you ever seen two snakes fucking? That's crazy. Two snails? Like,
I haven't, but I should.
Oh my God, look it up. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. You know, it's like, sex in nature is so inventive and so weird and like makes amazing shapes and looks strange to us. And it's like, I don't know. I think that's a part of this too, is just going like, yeah, the sex in this book is inventive, and it is kind of, it tells us so much about who these people are and what their relationship is to each other and their own bodies and the world. And it's, I don't know, I think as a wog as well, like, it's just, sex is always going to be a way I like write. Like, I just, things make sense to me through writing about sex, I guess. So I don't really see a world where I ever not write it. But yeah, there's heaps of it in the book.
Okay, so then what does the future look like for you? Because, you know, like we spoke about just before, this was something you never saw on your bingo card, right? Like, you know, now you're saying, I want to write about sex forever. This makes sense to me. What's on the cards for you now, past Eros?
Well, the last story in the book, Hermaphroditus, has been optioned as a play.
Oh my God, I was going to ask that. Surely there's something in this for theatre and the screen.
Yeah, that one's a play that I'm writing at the moment. First draft's actually due next week, which is awesome. It's like, it works, it just really lends itself to stage, that myth. And there's a film in there as well. I don't want to say too much, but for sure. And then I actually have just signed on with Hachette to do another book, which is awesome.
Huge, Zoe.
Yeah. It's a novel. It's not related to this. It's like it's a novel set in the 90s in Sydney about a gay Greek trans boy. You know, it's like kind of being a gay dude during AIDS, but then getting into a pretty fucked up relationship and sort of untangling yourself from that. Anyway, it spans the decades, this book, so it'll take me a minute. But that'll be out sometime.
Yes. I'm so excited. That I thought that when I was reading, I was like, this, because there's 5 short stories, but I was like, these can just be really drawn out.
Totally.
There's so much in this and you're such an incredible writer. Thanks, well, this has been the best. Where can people find the book, find you?
Yes. You can find the book at like most bookshops, I think. It should be in your local bookshop, I hope. But also like support a queer bookshop if you can.
Yeah.
But if not, yeah, you can get it online. You can go to a bookshop. You can find me on the internet, I suppose. I'm also doing a few more book tour events, one in Newcastle, one in Sydney. They're all on my Instagram. You can find it there.
Yes, and we'll put links in the show notes as well. But yeah, so you remember, it's Eros, Queerness for Lovers. Zoe, thank you so much for jumping in the studio and taking the time. This is the best.
Angel, it's been so nice. Thanks for having me.